Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure to present Christopher Simpson, the author of, among other titles, The Science of Coercion, subtitled Communication Research and Psychological Warfare, 1945 to 1980, published in softcover and hardcover by the Oxford University Press, copyright 1994. Chris, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thanks, Dave.
Now, in undertaking an examination of mass communication research and psychological warfare, a good starting place, Chris, would be to briefly define what we mean by each.
Psychological warfare is, as the Army put it, warfare designed to debilitate the enemy in one way or another. It includes violence, propaganda, covert operations, assassination, and so forth. It's called psychological only in that it produces a psychological effect. It's not limited to talking or to broadcasts over the radio. Communication research is a field, it's part of sociology, that grew up in the 1950s. And what it does, among other things, is train people in doing public opinion polling, in doing public relations work, in journalism, in various quantitative and qualitative ways of looking at what mass communication is.
You trace the relationship between mass communication research and psychological warfare to a number of overlapping developments. One of the chief developments, and something we touched on in our last interview, was an old boy network, which grew out of a series of professional and personal associations that developed during World War II between many of the guiding lights in what came to be mass communication research and people who were actively employed by the U.S. government in psychological warfare.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And part of what the book contends is that communication research, as it presently exists, could not have come about without the money, the contacts, the old boy network that you mentioned and so forth that was rooted in national security missions of one sort or another. And we can talk about specific missions in a moment. The important thing, or I think the most fundamental thing about all of this, is the extent to which we as a people, as a society, have limited our view of what communication is. And now this is like one of those words, it's kind of like freedom, you know, it kind of expands out, its meaning sort of expands out indefinitely. But the point that I'm trying to make here is that not all societies, not all cultures around the world look at communication the way that the United States does. We have a very strong tendency to the point that it almost seems as though it's natural or common sense that communication consists of me telling you to do something, or the radio or the television or the boss at work, whatever, giving directions. And that's what communication means.
On page 62, you write, as will become apparent, the dominant paradigm of the period proved to be in substantial part a paradigm of dominance in which the appropriateness and inevitability of elite control of communication was taken as a given. I think to a certain extent that could be said to be a posit to to the statement you just made.
Yeah, right, right. And that's written in kind of professor talk. But basically the idea is that we assume that, I'll give you an example. I mean, there were studies done in the early 1950s that are still referred to today, who were called communication studies, that looked at Central Asian republics of the USSR, Kazakhstan, and so forth. And if I can take a very brief sidetrack, these countries are much in the news these days. It's because they have enormous oil reserves, and there's a worldwide race, a gold rush, as to who's going to take control of these oil reserves.
By the way, Chris, many of the audiences listening to this have just heard a program that I did about some of that geopolitical petroleum-related maneuvering, so you're right on target.
Okay, all right. Well, in any case, getting back to the communication side of all this, the whole foundation upon which the study was done and the policy that flowed from it and so forth, the premise was that the U.S. government and its various security agencies would communicate in the sense of telling the Kazakhs and other peoples what we expected of them. The conception, the idea that there would be information coming back from Kazakhstan, they accepted that, but its only function was, the only reason the government was interested in it was so that it could improve the method by which it told the Kazakhs what to do. So feedback in this, so there's no communication here in the fundamental sense of the word. There is not an equality or a fundamental exchange of ideas. To the extent that it's two-way at all, its feedback is used to improve or to strengthen or rationalize the means of giving directions. And then, to take a step further from that, if you start thinking about what communication means in a religious sense, or in the sense of Eastern philosophies, or in the sense of almost any worldview other than consumer-style capitalism, well, it means quite different things to other societies. And study of that sort of thing was shut down and really made politically quite dangerous for several decades.
We're going to talk about some of the institutions and some of the history involved in developing this type of relationship, Chris. You talk about three key national security directives, which in many ways helped to solidify the relationship between government psychological warfare and, quote, private, unquote, note the quote, communications research, National Security Directives 4, 4A, and 10-2, which helped to lay the foundation for the relationship we're talking about.
Sure. Well, I think many of the listeners will be familiar with NSC 10-2. It's a foundation for the national security state in many respects. It's the basic framework for clandestine operations and the trail of coup d'états and assassinations that have flowed since the 1940s. 4 and 4A are kind of interesting more for what they reveal about how the national security elite think and how that process works. And it's much more bureaucratic than most people realize. I mean, there's a tendency to think that Alan Dulles or whomever sits down in a room with his cronies and makes this decision or that decision. But in reality, most of these things are done in a very bureaucratic way, and you have proposals that bubble their way up through the State Department and the Defense Department and the Department of Commerce, for heaven's sakes, and so on. And then these various interagency committees meet and hammer out the language, and of course the language, as most committees produce, as most your listeners know, the language becomes more and more vague and more and more amenable to a variety of interpretations. Okay, so what's that mean? In the case of 4 and 4A, what they did is that they passed NSC 4, and that said, okay, well, the Americans are under assault by Russian propaganda and communist expansionism, and therefore we need, the country needs a propaganda program to meet this challenge. And so that meant like the Voice of America, the agency that eventually emerged as the U.S. Information Agency, and so on. Now, this was secret. This was actually classified as confidential. The thing is with confidential ratings is that for legal reasons, literally hundreds of thousands of government employees have access to confidential, quote-unquote, papers, so that if the NSC has a confidential policy, it's generally on the front page of the newspapers within a week. And I'm talking about in the 1940s, not in the 1990s. In the 1990s, it's on the front page of the newspapers before the day is out. So the officially secret, i.e. officially confidential policy was, we were going to have a propaganda program that was going to be anti-communist. Now, minutes after passing NSC 4, they then turned to an entirely separate decision that was called NSC 4A. And this was classified top secret. And what that meant was that even acknowledging the existence of this decision was considered a violation of the law. So this decision officially did not even exist. And what it consisted of was presidential authorization for clandestine operations, sabotage, counterinsurgency, insurgency, assassinations, and so forth, you know the list, to carry out this same form of psychological warfare. So the interesting thing here is that you have sort of shells within shells, and that the different people who are players in this game can manipulate their language depending upon who they're talking to. If they're talking to the general public, they can say, well, psychological warfare means broadcasting over the voice of America. And I think most people would not get too worked up over that, frankly, for better or worse. But if they're talking to a different audience, psychological warfare has a quite different meaning, and it can mean overthrowing the government of Guatemala. So you have the creation of whole systems of euphemism and double talk and double think, even in a George Orwell type sense, on which the clandestine world thrived at that time and continues to thrive today.
On page 52, Chris, you have a stunning statement which illustrates the extent of overlap, and perhaps that's even the wrong term, between national security and mass communication research as an academic discipline. You write, the earliest cumulative data concerning government funding of social science is provided by the National Science Foundation in 1952. That report shows that over 96% of all reported federal funding of social science at that time was drawn from the U.S. military. That, I think, could be said to be a major outgrowth of those various national security documents and directives.
And think of it, let's leave aside for a moment the tendency to demonize the military, because,
sure,
frankly, I think that that's a real oversimplification of how the real world works.
I agree.
But from a strictly dollars and cents point of view, when the Pentagon went to the Congress and said, okay, well, we want $100 million to do X, the Congress is going to say, well, how exactly is what you're going to do advance the so-called security interests of the United States? Now, over the 40 years, more than 40 years now, that have transpired since 1950, what we've seen is a form of Keynesian economics in which military contracts are literally structured so that scoops of money go into the key congressional districts, and the contracts become a means of actually funding their pork barrel projects for congressmen. And this is what explains, for example, last year you have the Congress passing spending literally billions of dollars on advanced bombers that even the Pentagon, even the Joint Chiefs of Staff say, we don't want them. We don't need them. We can't use them. But the Congress comes along and says, no, we got to buy them. We got to build them. Why? It's because it means jobs in their district. So, you know, to bring this back around to the 1950s, and communication research, what it meant at that point was that in order to get funding, the projects had to be framed in such a way that it contributed to preparations for nuclear war, for example, to the execution or the carrying out of the Korean War, to the various espionage and insurgency tasks involved in overthrowing the government of Guatemala and Iran and Egypt, and you know the list that you've heard, and so on. So that to get funding for communication research, one had to be able to explain the research in such a way that it made some sort of contribution to those activities.
Chris, speaking of the 1950s Cold War climate, the manufacturing of bombers and communication research, something that touches on all of those shores is Project Revere. Tell us about that.
Project Revere was you know, if it wasn't so tragic, it would be humorous. But what it was, the University of Washington got a great big grant of money, mainly from the Air Force, the largest single grant of money for communication research of that decade, in which their project was to fly over towns in Montana and Idaho and Washington State and also down in Utah and Alabama and so on, and drop leaflets on these towns. And the leaflets said, this could have been a Soviet bomb, and you know, bombers can attack your neighborhood, and you have to be on alert and call such and such a telephone number to report that you've found this leaflet and to volunteer for, you know, these sky watching type of civil defense maneuvers. Now, a couple things about this. Number one is that this came right at the height of the so-called bomber gap, which was a manufactured thing that claimed that the Russians were far ahead of the United States in bombers, and that therefore the Americans had to invest a lot of money in building new and more sophisticated bombers, and so on. What even very conservative historians agree today is that the bomber gap was made up, and that it reflected a fight between the Air Force and the Army over control of nuclear weapons policy. But here you have, right in the middle of this argument, essentially a domestic argument in the United States, you have the Air Force dropping leaflets on towns in Montana saying, the Russians are coming, the Russians are coming. And this was an experiment in propaganda. In other words, how well did these leaflets work to get a message out? And it was a propaganda project in its own right. In other words, that it was publicity for a particular political point of view that the Air Force wished to promote.
Now, you describe Project Revere as being a diffusion study. Does that refer to the dissemination, the spreading of that message?
Yes, that's right. And diffusion is a whole subfield of communication research today. There's various people who wrote their dissertations based on Project Revere who are, to this day, the principal authors and kind of the grand old men of diffusion research in the United States. And they use that authority in terms of who sits on the editorial boards of what academic journals, who gets tenure, who doesn't get tenure, who gets appointed to this chair and not to that chair, and so forth and so on. So that these types of projects, this type of government backing, plays itself out in the little world of the university. And most people probably wouldn't care about that. But that, in turn, plays itself out in how do we train journalists? How do we train public relations people? What are the attitudes that universities and the education system in general attempt to instill in these people who then go out and are really the voices of our society?
To a certain extent, it's like those old boy networks made manifest and evolved through the years.
Yes, and evolved and in a sense grew in some organic way, if you follow me. I'd like to say something else about these diffusion studies, and that is, I'd like to say two other things. Number one is that dropping leaflets from airplanes has no civilian communication value whatever. Zero. Zilch. When was the last time anybody in the listening audience got advertising messages in the form of leaflets dropped from airplanes? It just doesn't happen. It is not functional as a civilian form of communication. What it is useful for, however, is two things. Number one, and this is exactly why the Air Force was funding it, was that in the midst of an atomic war, they were going to send bombers into those areas that had been hit by either American bombs over in Russia or by Russian bombs in the United States or in Europe, you know, you name the place, and then drop these leaflets as a means of communicating with societies that were in smoking ruins. That's one use for them. The other use for them, particularly during the mid-1950s, was they would load them up on balloons, high-altitude balloons. And the balloons would be set off, and they would float on the air currents over into, particularly into Eastern Europe and in some cases into China, where they would drop these leaflets, and the leaflets would say, you know, overthrow Stalin or freedom is coming, and, you know, these types of political messages. Now, those balloon programs played themselves out in two ways, one of them tragic and the other one ridiculous. The tragic one was that there was at least one case of a civilian Czech airliner whose controls for the aircraft became entangled in one of these flights of balloons, and the aircraft crashed, killing several dozen people. The United States government refused to take any responsibility whatever for this crash, despite the fact that it was a clandestine American program that had created the conditions that brought about this crash. The other way that it played itself out is in many of the so-called UFO sightings, and much of the, in what is, in my view, and I know this is not everybody will agree with me, but frankly, I think the preposterous claims that are made about UFOs, which you have secret government programs whose existence is officially denied, that consist of sending up balloons filled with leaflets that occasionally catch the light of one sort or another, and people on the ground say, oh my God, it's a UFO. And so then this, you know, translates out into the popular culture, into the form of X-Files and so on. Now, personally, you know, the question comes as, well, why should anybody care? I mean, The X-Files is an entertaining program. It's there's nothing wrong with it, is there? And in a sense, there isn't. But what troubles me about it is that we get ourselves into this sort of, into a cultural mode where we explain the problems that we have based on myths. And the myths are people from outer space, The myths in Nazi Germany were that the Jews were responsible. The myths in America are that we're not consuming enough, or that there are these, you know, kind of fantastic, elaborate, intergalactic events that somehow are conspiring against us, and so forth and so on. So take that for what it's worth. I don't buy a lot of the UFO stuff, and the reason is that I know exactly where it came from. Mm-hmm. And it came from these secret programs to fly balloons for propaganda purposes.
There's a researcher named Jacques Vallée who's done some remarkable work on the deliberate alien deception and also on some of the fascistic connections and overtones to some of the UFO cults. His name is Jacques Vallée, and some of his works, such as The Messengers of Deception and Revelations, have been accessed on this program. There are some remarkable aircraft of unconventional configuration, largely deriving from stealth technology.
Sure.
And the reconnaissance aircraft, which to a layperson would look like a UFO. But Vallée has done some research which complements what you just said, and he's demonstrated very conclusively that both extremes with regard to the UFO question, one that there's nothing at all, whereas people have seen some of these extraordinary aircraft which have various applications that are kept secret, and on the other hand, the aliens are among us and giving us their technology and we should let them rule us, has been deliberately disseminated by some of the most shady of our national security interests. Chris, we're running low on time on this side. On the other side, I'd like to discuss some of the institutions which exemplify and perpetuated the marriage of psychological warfare and mass communication research in the United States. Institutes such as the Bureau of Applied Social Research and publications such as Public Opinion Quarterly. That, however, in our next half-hour segment. We've been visiting with Chris Simpson, the author of, among other titles, The Science of Coercion, Communication Research and Psychological Warfare, 1945 to 1980, hard and soft cover editions, published by Oxford University Press, copyright 1994. Chris, we'll join you in our next half-hour.
I look forward to it.